Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 7, What Prahlad Learned in the Womb, Text 1. Shri Narada Vacha Evam Daicha Sutai Prishto Mahabhagavato Sira Vacha Tan Smayamana Smaran Mad Anubhashitam. Start reading with text 28 of the previous chapter. Prahlad Maharaj continued, I received this knowledge from the great Saint Narada Muni, who is always engaged in devotional service. This knowledge, which is called Bhagavad Dharma, is fully scientific. It is based on logic and philosophy and is free from all material contamination. Text 29 to 30. The sons of the demons replied, Dear Prahlad, neither you nor we know any teacher or spiritual master other than Sanda and Amarka, the sons of Shukracharya. After all, we are children and they are our controllers. For you especially, who always remain within the palace, it is very difficult to associate with a great personality. Dear friend, most gentle one, would you kindly explain how it was possible for you to hear Narada? Kindly dispel our doubts in this regard. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 7th canto, 6th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Prahlad Instructs His Demoniac Schoolmates. 7th chapter, text 1. Narada Muni said, Although Prahlad Maharaj was born in a family of asuras, he was the greatest of all devotees. Having thus been questioned by his class friends, the sons of the asuras, he remembered the words spoken to him by me and replied to his friends as follows. Purport. When he was in the womb of his mother, Prahlad Maharaj listened to the words of Narada Muni. One cannot imagine how the baby in the embryo could hear Narada, but this is spiritual life. Progress in spiritual life cannot be obstructed by any material condition. This is called ahituki-yapratiyata. Reception of spiritual knowledge is never checked by any material condition. Thus, Prahlad Maharaj, from his very childhood, spoke spiritual knowledge to his class friends, and certainly it was effective, although all of them were children. Om Agyana Chirmidandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nittananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. We're dealing with some extraordinary contradictions here. First of all, Prahlad within the womb, hearing transcendental knowledge and remembering it. From the material point of view, this seems to be contradictory in that there's no precise knowledge of the extent that a child can have consciousness within the womb today. That knowledge is not available in ordinary society. And they wouldn't dare to think about it too deeply, because then current society becomes face to face with the fact that the termination of the unborn children in the womb is a great atrocity. But here you have Srimad Bhagavatam presenting to you the transcendental career of Prahlad Maharaj and how within the womb he heard perfectly the instructions of his spiritual master. So that's one thing. And then the next thing is, who is Prahlad Maharaj's audience? He's speaking to children. not simply children, but children of demoniac families. They're all tiny little kids, yet Prahlad is speaking things that the greatest scientist, the greatest scholar of today can't understand. And thirdly, another contradiction. Prahlad, he's Daityasuta. He's the son of a demon, yet at the same time, he's Mahabhagavata, the exalted devotee of the Lord, although born in a family of demons. So all these contradictions are going on. And in this way, we can understand that there are no material impediments to the distribution of transcendental knowledge and to the reception of transcendental knowledge. The activity is on the spiritual platform. The distribution and the reception is on the spiritual platform. It simply seems that material conditions have something to do with it. Just like when you go to the holy Dham, Vrindavan Dham, Mayapur Dham, externally, those places seem like just some dusty town with lots of chaos. But according to the level of your spiritual realization, you can sense with budding spiritual senses that something else is going on. You notice how your thinking, feeling, and willing in connection to Krishna becomes stronger and stronger. So then you naturally begin to doubt how accurate your material sense perception is. And that's good. This is part of humility. Humility doesn't mean simply to speak in a soft voice and offer pranams to whoever you meet. Humility actually begins with doubting the inputs of your material senses. And many persons have a difficult time with that. Even some of our own devotees, they can't adjust to the basic transcendental fact. Atas Sri Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Grayam Indre Seva Mukhihi Jivadal Swayam Eva Spratyada. No one can understand the transcendental name, form, qualities, and pastimes of Krishna with their ordinary senses. But if you engage in the spiritual process of bhakti, Swayam Eva Spratyada, the transcendental reality becomes revealed to you. So here you have Prahlad. His material circumstances of birth are totally unfavorable. In fact, even before he was born, he's in the womb, which is a great obstacle from the material point of view. Yet he heard transcendental knowledge in the womb, then took birth in a family of demons, and now he's speaking to 5-year-old little kids, knowledge that even the greatest scientist or scholar today has great difficulty comprehending. He's explaining the science of the soul. He's explaining the science of the Supreme Soul and the relationship between the two. And he's talking that to 5-year-old children. This is how empowered he is. Not only 5-year-old children, but little kids born in demoniac families. He's speaking to them during their recess break at school. And he's telling them things that devastate the material conception of life and firmly establish Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You study the instructions Prahlad Maharaj gave, and all aspects of material life and spiritual life become illuminated. Aspects that, as I said, even the greatest scholars and scientists today, they can't get out of the darkness. Just like, for example, when I'm speaking at universities, I spoke at Stanford Tuesday, and I always quote someone who is arguably the most famous material scientist in the world, Stephen Hawking. What do you think about this? He says his instruction to you all is just face it. You're simply chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. Just basic. Get over all the other spiritual stuff. Get over all your other aspirations and dreams. You're just chemical scum. Just face it. So this is the the great exemplar of contemporary knowledge. Of course, Prahlad Maharaj easily dissipates such fantasies. What I explain to the students is, look, out of prejudice, out of bias, you think that it is very miraculous how there could be a spiritual energy as well as a material energy. You think that that is very inconceivable, and that's really stretching things, because all you can perceive with your senses is matter. So when we come to you and explain to you at the Bhakti Club about the science of the soul, you may think that it's interesting, but isn't that kind of outdated, kind of mythological? You're positing that there's some kind of spiritual substance. Now, who's ever seen it? Who's ever measured it? Who's ever analyzed it with laboratory techniques, which are the proof of everything? So it sounds very interesting that there's a spiritual energy besides the material energy. But it's very miraculous. So I point out to them, all right, let's take your words, your point of view, your bias, your prejudice at face value. That there is the spirit self that doesn't change when the body changes. That your conscious awareness is independent of your brain. Let's take that as indeed miraculous and perhaps far-fetched. Now, if you're truly open-minded and objective, you have to admit that your idea that the self is simply of the brain and that conscious awareness arises from biochemical reactions in the brain, that's also miraculous. So take your pick. You say that we're dealing with miracles. We say you're dealing with miracles. You put your faith completely in matter, and we put our faith in the spiritual energy and the source of the spiritual energy. So which miracle are you going to go for? It's not that you are so above all inconceivable thinking. You place in matter achintya shakti. It can do the impossible. It can produce consciousness. It can produce life. That's your faith. That's your miracle. We don't accept your miracle. We're asking you to accept our miracle. Now, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives the process for verifying the spiritual energy. Every time we chant Hare Krishna, every time we engage in kirtan, every time we take prasad, we are verifying the existence of the spiritual energy. And as we make more advancement, we understand that Krishna is always present with all his energies. So we have a process. You may not accept it, but at least we have a process to verify the spiritual reality, the spiritual miracle, if you want to call it that. Now tell us, what is your process for verifying that matter gives rise to life and consciousness? We want to know it now. Don't tell us about the future. We want to know now. In the few hundred years of science as you know it, has there been any direct proof that matter gives rise to the self and consciousness and life? No. Yet we have the most wonderful texts, Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. And they present the experience of persons far greater than Stephen Hawking. And they present the procedure to verify what these great souls are saying. So where do you want to place your bet, you know? You can gamble in this way. Actually, Prabhupada said that this is a gamble that you can make. We don't gamble, it's against regular principles, but here's one gamble you can make. You gamble on Krishna, that Krishna is right. you'll always win. So you're allowed to make that gamble. But, Prabhupada explained, even if you think you're going to lose by gambling on Krishna, what's the big deal anyway? Your whole life has been as a loser. What's one more loss? You won't lose. But even if you think you're going to lose, big deal. You're a loser anyway. But of course you won't lose. You'll win big. So therefore, gamble on Krishna. So this is basically our message when we're speaking at universities, colleges. Gamble on Krishna. Take your choice of which miracle you want to believe in. Which miracle offers the process of verification? Which miracle offers the greatest personality supporting it? Topics that bewilder the greatest thinkers of today. Prahlad Maharaj at 5 years old easily deals with. Just like when he speaks about the allurement between male and female and how the two entangle one another in conditioned life. Prahlad's 5 years old and he just talks about it in such a brilliantly insightful way. Then if you ask arguably the world's most famous scientist, he was asked, what, you've mastered physics, you've mastered the cosmos, your speculations have covered the world. Is there anything you find difficult to understand? You know what he said? I can't understand women. They totally bewilder me. I can understand the most complex equations. I can understand the most complex formulas. But women, oh my gosh, I can't figure them out. Prahlad Maharaj just speaks in depth about it at 5 years old. So, at least you can see the difference between sources of mundane knowledge and sources of spiritual knowledge. Now, Prahlad Maharaj admits that it's difficult to understand the bhakti knowledge. You heard in text 27, such knowledge is extremely difficult to understand without the mercy of a saintly person like Narada. But everyone who has taken shelter of Narada's disciple succession can understand this confidential knowledge. So this point is difficult for the material intelligence to accept. Why is it that my understanding of a particular knowledge is dependent on my contact with a particular person, even my pleasing of a particular person? This sounds like sorcery. This sounds like some kind of tribal black magic or something. I'm me, I have my intelligence, you just put the knowledge in front of me and I can understand it. What's the difficulty? It's like any knowledge that you learn in school. You cram it into your brain, you take the test, you know it. What's the problem? But that is the difference between mundane knowledge and Divya Gyan. What Prahlad Maharaj is explaining to his friends is indeed Divya Gyan. And the nature of that Divya Gyan, that divine knowledge, is that it's understood from the right persons. You receive it in the right way, and you try to please those persons who give you the Divya Gyan. And then you understand it more. It becomes more alive for you. That's why every morning we sing in Prabhupada's Guru Puja, Divya Gyan Hriday Prakashito. You fill my heart with transcendental knowledge. You make it manifest, prakash. You make it luminous in my heart. There's no mundane academic process about it. So then Prahlad Maharaj explains that I received this knowledge from Narada Muni. He's always engaged in devotional service. Therefore, Prahlad could understand the knowledge even in adverse material circumstances within the womb. Actually, it's not anymore so far-fetched that a child could show some kind of intelligence in the womb. Scientists today have photographed children in the womb dancing to music that their mother's listening to. I've seen it with my own eyes. Certain sound vibrations, I think extremely low sound vibrations, penetrate into the womb. And so you can actually see scans of children dancing. So if they can dance, they can hear. And Prahlad, because he's a special child, he was hearing perfectly. Even though he's born in a demoniac family. And now he's perfectly speaking to his little school children, friends, who are also born in demoniac families. Now, what does Narada Muni point out is Prahlad's technique? Narada Muni says, he remembered the words spoken to him by me and replied to his friends as follows. Because Prahlad is repeating the words of the parampara, his words are able to conquer over material circumstances. I remember when I was here in Los Angeles in the mid-70s filing all Srila Prabhupada's letters to him, letters from him. So I got to see both sides. And there was a whole series of letters where devotees were asking Prabhupada how to preach, how to present the science of Krishna. And he would basically answer that question again and again and again in the same way. He would say with varying words, but the same point. How do you preach? You cram my purports. You memorize my purports and repeat them. And then gradually your own style will develop. Your own style in presenting the message. Not that you make up a new message. But you present that same message, but because we're all individuals, your own style will naturally develop simply by cramming the purports. Indeed, sometimes he would say memorizing the purports and repeating them, and then gradually your spiritual individuality will manifest. Sometimes we have this fear that by following strictly in the parampara, I'll be a clone. I've even heard an expression which I found very intriguing. If you try to simply repeat the message of parampara and follow in the footsteps of parampara, you risk becoming a cookie-cutter devotee. You know what a cookie-cutter is, right? It's like a mold. You get the cookie batter, and you just stamp out cookies in various shapes with this mold. So the fear is that I'll be a cookie-cutter devotee. I won't have my own variegatedness. It's amazing how attached we are to our material individuality. This is body attachment. And we take our minds so seriously. We have no idea of our real individuality, but we cling so tightly to the material conception of ourselves. Here you see Prahlad Maharaj, such a vibrant individual. And Narada Muni is saying, he remembered the words spoken to him by me. And that's what he was telling his friends. Now, how is it that by pleasing a person, pleasing the devotee, you understand, you comprehend? This is another barrier in our mind. Isn't my understanding my own thing? It depends on my intellect, my worldly experience, my abilities. How is it that understanding transcendental knowledge depends so much on my pleasing a person? Remember Krishna at the school of Sandarpani Muni? With the future Sudama Brahmana, how they were on a mission to get some ingredients for yajna. They went to the forest on behalf of their guru, and there was an extraordinary storm, rain and wind, and they were marooned. They were just apparently trapped in the forest and had to stay the night there in such hurricane Sandy conditions. And then in the morning, the guru came looking for them, along with his other disciples. And when he found them, Krishna was reminding Sudama Brahmana about this. Do you remember? And so when Sandipani Muni found Krishna and Sudama Brahmana, he told them, this is very exemplary. This is what spiritual life is all about. You abandon all selfish conceptions about pleasing yourself. You didn't mind inconvenience. You simply tried to please the devotee. Therefore, I bless you that you'll be able to understand the message of the parampara. I bless you that that message of the parampara will not fade in you. This is very important for our daily life, because often devotees will say, well, we've seen, especially around here in Southern California, we've seen devotees who seem to know something, and then their Krishna consciousness seems to have faded, and once again they became candidates for suffering in the material world. What's going to prevent me from becoming like that? If persons who evidently were greater than me, they succumbed, why should I think that I will be safe? Maybe I should just, you know, fall down now and avoid the traffic jam. Just get on with it, you know. Why drag it out? Why the suspense? So we start to assume that it's natural that over time your enthusiasm fades. When you're a young devotee, you're what they call fired up. And you're very enthusiastic. Whatever service you're told to do, yes, yes, Prabhu, yes, yes. But it seems that we should consider that it's natural that over time that enthusiasm is going to fade. All the shlokas that you memorize when you're a young devotee, you're going to forget. All that reading time you did is not going to happen anymore. And those days when you really tried to chant japa and hear the holy name, all that's just going to fade due to the power of time. Now, in one sense, we have a right to think like that. Because in Bhagavad Gita, what does Krishna say? Beginning of the fourth chapter. Sakalenaha mahata yoga nashta prantapa. Arjuna, due to the force of time, the purport of Bhagavad Gita was lost. So Krishna doesn't cover up. He lets you know there's some problems in the material world. The material world is problematic. Due to the pressure of the time factor, even the meaning of Bhagavad Gita becomes lost. So Krishna says, I have to come again and again to revive it. So yes, there is that impediment caused by the passing of time. We can see that. I was speaking about this yesterday at the Bhakti house. What are people going to do to have a lasting relationship when time just obliterates all the romantic buzz? Yeah, people want to be together. They want to be in fulfilling relationships, however they define that. But meanwhile, time is doing its thing. So I was giving them the current materialistic understanding, which is that although human technology and society have evolved, human psychology has not evolved sufficiently to the same level. Human psychology is still trapped on the level of when people had a lifespan of 35 years. And that was just a few hundred years ago, according to what we're told. So that means if you're, let's say, even go as far back, even as recent, rather, as a few hundred years ago in London, your average lifespan as a lower class person, if you're not part of the aristocracy, and even the aristocracy would succumb to death early, but especially if you were, there was no real middle class, so if you were just a non-aristocrat, your average lifespan was very, we would consider short and brutish, a hard struggle. So you can expect to live to your 35. That means when you married, it was only going to be for about 11 years. And you could be sure that either the husband or wife was going to die before you. You could be sure of that. So you didn't have to really worry about long-term relationships. Death would solve all marital problems. But the understanding is that nowadays, due to advances in medical science, people are living into their mid-70s. But their human psychology is not evolved to the level of medical science. So therefore, the human psychology that has evolved is not able to handle lifelong relationships, even though people want that. They have this longing, but they don't have the hardware. Evolution has not given them the hardware to fulfill their desires. Therefore, generally, they can't get past 11 years. What is it called? The 11-year itch or something like that? And so now you have the situation in the USA in which the majority of children live in homes that both original parents aren't there. And for women who are under 30, the majority of their children born to them are out of marriage. So therefore, you have this battle between the arch-conservatives in politics and the arch-liberals. The arch-conservatives say, family, family, we need family values, we need to support the family. And the arch-liberals, what do they say? Hey, all glories to the family, we're not against it, but it's not there. Face it, guys. It's not happening. So what do you want out of us? It's not that we're against traditional family, but it's non-existent and it's disappearing more and more with every year. So we're just coping with reality, that's all. So, I was explaining last night that one solution that's come up from brilliant material knowledge is that although people want lasting relationships, their evolutionary hardware is not sufficient to help them have a lifelong relationship with someone. Therefore, what is needed is biochemical relationship enhancement. Since falling in love is so much of a chemical arrangement, therefore, why not synthesize those neurochemicals that activate when you fall in love? Package them as a nasal spray. And then, when you're having some relationship problem, you just get a little bottle of oxytocin. That's the brain chemical that goes wild, signifying you're falling in love. It makes your head spin and, you know, the whole world looks different. And you sing funny songs and say funny things and talk all kinds of pillow talk. So that's oxytocin. It's true that so much of what people call falling in love is just biochemistry. And scientists will say it's all biochemistry. We'll say that underneath all the illusion is the soul's desire to have the love supreme with the supreme lovable object. So anyway, okay, you got a relationship problem? Bring out the spray, the oxytocin spray. Oh. You look so nice. So these are prestigious scientists who are starting to say this. Look, we got to help human society out. They've got these desires and they're going crazy because they're not fulfilled. And they can actually see by research that children who are in stable homes are happier. They admit that. And that man and woman in a stable relationship are actually happier. But it's not happening. So therefore, why not some chemical help? So, what the material intelligence can come up with is endlessly mutable. And it makes you wonder, if technology is so sophisticated, what am I doing thinking that I should please a person in order to understand things? That seems so primitive, doesn't it? It seems so non-scientific, non-laboratory-like.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur's statement, Krishna se toma, Krishna dite paro. Krishna, you're the property of your devotee. I'm simply running after the devotee shouting Krishna, Krishna. He doesn't say he's running after Krishna. He says he's running after the devotee. You see, this is Krishna's system. Accepting that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead means we accept Krishna's system for doing things. And he says, I'm understood by your pleasing my devotee. That's Krishna's personal system. Our whole life is filled with us trying to please persons. Partners, bosses, teachers at school. Why is it we jump back when Krishna says, please my devotee, then you'll understand. We're not dealing with ordinary knowledge. We're dealing with Divya Gyan. And that Divya Gyan is accessed and realized by pleasing a person. So this is exactly what Sandipani Muni told to Krishna and Sudama when they were young students at the Gurukula. Because you please me, I'm going to give you the ability that you'll never forget the Vedic conclusions. Time won't have an effect on your knowledge and realization, just like time has an effect on relationships. Our most dear relationships, time corrodes the affection in those relationships. And in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna points out that time makes it so that the real purport of Bhagavad Gita disappears. Not for those, of course, who approach Krishna through parampara. And that's the immunity that Sandipani Muni granted to Krishna and Sudama. Your realizations will be immune to the passing of time. And that is Krishna letting us know that as devotees, if we continuously try to please Krishna's devotee, our knowledge and realizations will remain intact. Certainly they'll even grow. So on the one hand, the fear is justified. I'm a young devotee. I may be fired up now. I'm reading the books now. I'm trying to chant. But what about the future? Won't time corrode my enthusiasm? That's a legitimate fear. But if we dedicate our life to pleasing the devotee, we'll be immune. Our knowledge and realization will be immune to the passing of time. And in fact, everything will become fresher and fresher and fresher. I was just in San Francisco with Vaisheshika Prabhu. And we were talking about how we've got to bring back the luster, the spotlight for Bhagavad Gita. Because it seems that devotees, as the decades have gone by, have kind of retired Bhagavad Gita. We know it all. It's a basic book. And it's quite provocative in some places. So let's just offer obeisances to it as it sits on the bookshelf. And we all know that it's kind of not the book that you want to present to people, you know, because they might, they might not be so impressed by all that Sanskrit and some of those things that Prabhupada says in the purport. So in this way, maybe we become a bit mental, you know? So, we were discussing how to make a campaign to get devotees off the mental platform and back into Bhagavad Gita. So as we were discussing that, we heard the news that New Dwarka has a goal for distributing 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas. Yes. So I shouldn't say this, but are they really doing that? I didn't say that, but are they really doing that? Quick, let's call up Shastra. Quick, find out what's going on. Because the San Jose goal was 16,000. So how are they doing 20,000? Our goal is 16. Is it really happening? So a phone call was actually made to Shastra Kit. What's really going on there? Are they really doing it? So the result of the conversation was, yeah, they're really doing it. That's really great. So, just think if Bhagavad Gita becomes world renowned amongst the Hare Krishnas as the prime book. Let's bring the luster back to Bhagavad Gita. Let's not mental out about it having things that, you know, people won't understand immediately. There's so much in this world that people don't understand immediately. Why, you know, why just Bhagavad Gita? Scientists will tell you that 90 to 95% of all the substance of the universe is unknown to them. They call it dark matter or dark energy. They don't have no idea what it is. 95% of the substance of the universe. And yet here we are afraid that there's some things in Bhagavad Gita that, when my mother visits me, should I show her Bhagavad Gita? Just see Prahlad Maharaj's enthusiasm. Narada Muni is explaining, he remembered the words spoken to him by me, and he was replying to his friends. Ordinarily, the knowledge is difficult to understand. We don't shy away from that. As we heard, such knowledge is extremely difficult to understand without the mercy of a saintly person like Narada. But Srila Prabhupada wanted to establish a global mission in which persons could get the mercy of a devotee, and then they would understand. Everyone who has taken shelter of Narada's disciple succession can understand this confidential knowledge. So rather than our mentaling out, we should give people the opportunity to understand Bhagavad Gita by contacting a devotee, by serving a devotee. Give ourselves that opportunity to understand Bhagavad Gita by dedicated service to a devotee, just like Krishna and Sudama demonstrated in the forest, trying to carry out service to their guru. Now, actually, of course, there's no question of Krishna undergoing austerities and penances in a hurricane. But the acharyas explain that Krishna conjured up the whole storm just to make the point that service to the devotee, regardless of your own personal inconvenience, that's the way to understand. So Krishna caused that whole storm to appear just to underline the point that humble service to the devotee is what pleases him the most, and it's what allows you to understand the science of bhakti. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Prabhupada ki jai.